Well, welcome back. Tuesday, September 22nd, as we head into Hour 2. It is a delight to bring back our good friend, Roger Kimball. He is, of course, the editor and publisher of the New Criterion magazine, publisher of Encounter Books, and he had a wonderful essay up at American Greatness, Americans Know What Time It Is. Subtitle, there are many signs, including the announcement by the president of the 1776 Commission, that the conscience of the country is awakening. Roger, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Seth. It's great to be with you again.
Thank you. Who would have guessed that an announcement by the president that we are going to have the Department of Education issue recommendations and guidance on the study of our country's history to be such a controversial thing, such that respected liberals would say that it reminds them of Mao Zedong? Who would have expected we would have come to such a point after generations of poor teaching about our American history, after commission after commission has wrung its hands about the state of American history in this country, it being our worst subject? Hearings in the Senate, hearings in the House. How is this Mao Zedong?
Yes. Well, of course, that was Susan Rice who said that.
Yeah.
Barack Obama's national security advisors, that she was astonished listening to the president, that she felt as though she were listening to a rally speech by the communist dictator. Well, this has been going on for a long time, Seth. It's no surprise, really. This attack on America, on American institutions, on the values that made America great, freedom, liberty, enterprise, all those sorts of things, has been going on at least since the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the curious thing is, you know, we saw a great efflorescence of activism in the 60s. Centered around things like the Vietnam War and so on. But it was more than that. It was much deeper than that. I think it was Abby Hoffman who said that, you know, you get rid of the Vietnam War, that's okay. We'll find 12 other things to replace it with.
Right.
We are basically against the American regime.
Mm-hmm.
We don't like capitalism. We don't like the free market system. We don't like the emphasis on individuality. We don't like a lot of things about this country. So there was one pretty well-known professor who said, in the early 2000s, he said, you know, a lot of people thought then that when things got quiet in the 90s, in the early 2000s, that we had kind of, we from that activist generation, gone back into our holes and had lost our radicalism, but we hadn't. You know, now we have tenure, and we're coming back to, we're coming back to challenge the system once again. And indeed, they have. What we are seeing now is a reprise of the radicalism of the 1960s, but with this difference: there's a new virulence to this radicalism because the ambient culture, the culture of the corporations, of suburbia, and so on, has itself been radicalized. You don't necessarily think of it being radicalized, but in many ways it has. And the sign of this, of course, is the abject capitulation of all kinds of corporations, all kinds of institutions, to the moral blackmail of Black Lives Matter. I mean, I live in a small neighborhood of about 100 houses on Long Island Sound in Fairfield County, Connecticut. And I would say six or seven of my neighbors have Black Lives Matter signs stuck in their front lawn. They have no idea.
That was my question. Do they? Yeah.
They have
right. That
no
was my
idea,
question.
You know?
Right.
And I know that the Black Lives Matter, like Antifa, has been taking, and the Ronald McDonald lady who was behind the 1619 Project, that they've taken down some of their more extreme statements. But they're easy to find. And we know that Black Lives Matter is as they said, you know, we're a Marxist trained organization bent on the destruction of this country and the destruction of the nuclear family. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, now, what
I find so refreshing about the president is that I can't think of another president who would have waded into this in the forthright way that he has. His speech the other day at the National Archives was a mini masterpiece. He was very forthright. He said, you know, these are what we are seeing is in our schools, in our colleges, and other institutions is a concerted effort to teach people to hate this country. And that's exactly what it is. And the fact, of course, that it's not just in schools and universities, and it goes right down to the primary schools, by the way, but it's also, in corporations, in the human resources departments of corporations, and even in the federal government. Christopher Rufo has been doing great work exposing the extent to which, in the Department of the Treasury, yep, in the FBI, right, in the Department of Homeland Security, even the laboratories that are making our nuclear arsenal, that they have all these workshops teaching people to hate themselves and hate the country. And it's horrible.
One of the things, there's so much in what you said, agree with all of it. One of the things that you said, though, was when you were talking about how suffused this is, I don't think people have any idea to begin with it. I mean, you and I, you actually pointed out, I did a lot of this. I mean, the Smithsonian. Most people have no idea what they did, which was, about a month and a half ago?
One of the
perhaps most stomach-churning pieces of racist bigotry I have ever seen, not in just a government document, but in anything that could be circulated by a private organization, identifying traits to recognize how someone would be a member of the race. And, of course, their examples were absurd. But the notion that the Smithsonian could engage in check marks to identify people by a race, first to identify them, and then the absurd check marks one had to do. You might just be white if you adhere to Christianity, which I'm sure would have been a heck of a surprise to Martin Luther King Jr. and Reverend Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson. That's how bad it was. But that was one of those things.
Yes, and that's the tip of the iceberg.
The tip,
That's because, you know, what were some of the other things? Hard work, rational thinking, science.
Right.
These are all traits of whiteness that should be expunged. I mean, it's... not everyone.
Leisure after work. Do you remember that one?
Yeah. No, I recommend that your listeners Google that or duck go it or whatever. It's really worth looking at it. It's been rescinded now, I believe. But still, this tells you what they think.
In part, but they still have that. So they took down that noxious, stomach-churning, queasy chart. You're right. Mm-hmm. But they have a lecture at the Smithsonian in there on the issue of whiteness by a Marxist. They have bell hooks lecturing us on the problem of whiteness. I mean, this is what our government tax dollars are now paying for at the Smithsonian. You know, the folks that give you the National Portrait Gallery.
Yes, right. But the irony in all of this, of course, is that it is an implicit repudiation of everything that Martin Luther King stood for.
Of course,
right. Remember, Martin Luther King said, "What counts is not the color of your skin, but the content of your character." This totally inverts that and says the primary thing about you is your race, and then they put the little codicils about gender and sexual preference and so on. But it's your race. That is what defines you. And that, of course, is the very definition of racism. And it's repugnant and should be resisted. And, of course, the reason I mentioned the conscience of America perhaps awakening is not just the president's initiative and these great scholars he had there talking about this problem, but there are beginning to be concrete proposals to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, absolutely right. It was a lot of wringing of hands on our side, too. And what were we going to do about it? I have to hit a break. Are you able to stay one more segment, Roger?
Yeah, sure.
I would love that. Thank you. There's so much to talk about here, and it's always a delight to have you. I'm Seth Leibson. We'll be back with a little bit more from Roger Kimball when we return. He, of course, is the editor and publisher of The New Criterion and the publisher of Encounter Books. His piece over at American Greatness, I really do want to urge upon you. Americans know what time it is. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Delighted to have Roger Kimball with us. He is, of course, the publisher of Encounter Books and the editor and publisher of Great Magazine, Important Magazine, The New Criterion. His piece in American Greatness, must reading, Americans Know What Time It Is. And Roger, as you were talking with me in the previous segment, the springboard was really what the president announced on Constitution Day, which was a recommitment to inspired teaching about the founding, and the left in this country roared back against such a thing with such a loud and odd response. One wondered what they were so afraid of, and I think what they were afraid of was the pushback, because they have thought for some time now that they were able to control our historical narrative and were getting away with it pretty well until this guy woke up, don't you think?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The president may be a somewhat odd ambassador for our recovery, but he's an incredibly effective one. I mean, I can't think of another president who would do what he did, who would actually take the time to absorb what was toxic about critical race theory.
Right.
I mean, what a strange academic thing. But right. You know, it's been around since the 90s. Yeah. But he Chris Rufo, I think, his presentation on Tucker Carlson awakened the president to this awful thing that was going on, not only in colleges and universities, but right under his nose in all of these federal departments. And I can't think of another president who would actually have acted with the alacrity and the intelligence and the effectiveness with which he did. I mean, to have this commission to really set up what amounts to a two-part strategy. The first part is to expose it, to show people exactly what it is that's been going on. And of course, in this way, the Chinese virus is our friend, because so many students are now at home.
That's right.
Doing their classes on Zoom.
That's right.
And their parents are kind of looking over their shoulder saying, oh my God.
You're being taught what? Yeah.
Yeah. What is this? You know, this is what we're paying for.
Right.
And so that's the first part. And the second part, of course, is the remediation. And, you know, I think if I could pause for a commercial break here. Encounter recently published what I think is a terrific book, one of the most important books we've published, called Land of Hope, an Invitation to the Great American Story.
I'm a huge McClay fan. Oh, yeah, I love the guy.
Yeah, Wilford McClay. And, you know, my idea when suggesting this book to Bill, he goes by Bill, is this could be an alternative to Howard Zinn.
Right.
The president mentioned Howard Zinn. Mm-hmm. His People's History of the United States should actually be called the Anti-American History of the United States. It sold millions of copies. It is the scripture from which this anti-American gospel is promulgated, and it sort of insinuated itself into the educational establishment so thoroughly that it's practically inescapable. A few years ago, I was taking my son around to various high schools near where we live, and in almost every one, this was a required textbook, and sometimes not just in history, often in English as well. And so it's sort of everywhere, and it's the gospel of anti-Americanism. And the president mentioned this, and it's so great that, you know, now there is an alternative.
Yes.
And it's not this Bill McClay's book is not right-wing history. It's It's the true story of America, which, if told honestly, is an incredible success story. It doesn't mean we didn't make mistakes, that there weren't, you know, blind alleys, you know, things that were less than edifying. Of course, that's true of every country. But the fact remains that this is the greatest country on earth, and it's an incredible success story. So I'm very happy about that. And I just one other very brief commercial announcement.
No, you earned it. You earned it.
Forthcoming is a book by Peter Wood, who was also on this panel, the director of the National Association of Scholars. Yeah. And we're bringing out next month his book called The 1620, which is an answer to the 1619 Project. And he argues that the real founding of the country was in the Mayflower Compact, which happened in 1620. And it's a very robust and forthright response to the series of lies and calumnies which motivate the 1619 Project, you know, chief of which is the twin ideas that America was founded as a slaveocracy, and secondly, that the American Revolution was fought in order to preserve the institution of slavery, which is, I mean, it's so repugnant you don't even know quite how to respond.
I'm so glad that you're doing that and that you birthed Maclay's book. I think of Maclay's book and actually the kinds of history I grew up with, too. I mean, I think I was reading the textbooks of Samuel Eliot Morrison and Henry Commager. And they, too, were not, they, like Maclay, I would put it this way, they show America warts and all, whereas Zinn shows America warts and that's all. And that's the
right.
Weird kind of notion that the left thought they had to go to get us through their children. I'll quote Allen Ginsberg there, right? You know that, that story.
Yes, we'll get you through your children.
Right, to Norman, I think it was, right? And, and that's where the great corrective needs to circle back. I heard the president give that speech, and I saw the transcript, and he actually says literally, verbatim, "We will encourage our educators to teach our children about the miracle of American history." I thought, interesting word, encourage. I've heard that word before. Where? Northwest Ordinance of 1787. Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. And I thought, aha, but that's what the left hates. They hate 1787, don't they?
yeah, to give courage to is what that word means etymologically, of course. No, you're absolutely right. Something you said a moment ago, I think, requires perhaps even greater emphasis. And that is that the left believes that they have a monopoly on culture.
Yeah.
Because they understand, as Andrew Breitbart said, that politics is downstream from culture.
Yep.
They know that if they have that, as Allen Ginsberg said, as you quoted, we'll get you through your children.
Yeah.
If we have the schools, if we have the media, if we have these institutions of culture, that were all of these institutions were designed to preserve and transmit the ennobling values of our culture. Now, alas, they have been turned on their head and are deconstructing or otherwise repudiating them. And I think the awakening that I mentioned is I think that people looking around and seeing all these people burning down stuff and listening to people like Susan Rice and so on, understand that this is not the America they want.
No, it is not, Roger. It is not. God bless you, sir. Thank you for doing what you're doing. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for this great essay. Thank you for publishing those books.
All right, Seth. It's great to chat.
God bless you. Godspeed. We'll talk soon.
I hope so.
Thank you.
Bye.
It's just hard to be in a bad mood when you hear Lionel Richie, right? I want to remind you folks about Dinesh D'Souza's latest film, Trump Card. It's a film you must see to understand the socialism, corruption, and gangsterism of the modern Democratic Party and help President Trump to stop it. Pre-order your DVD and video on demand now at watchtrumpcard.com. That's watchtrumpcard.com. Caller earlier, Rob from Surprise, poised the questions. posed the question.
Posed it with poise.
Posed it with poise. That's nice. Thank you very much, Connie. That does the Supreme Court nominee that Donald Trump puts forward, and I guess he's going to name her on Saturday, and he said it would be a her. Thinking is it's probably Amy Barrett at this point. I think she's been to the White House twice since Friday. In any event, does that nomination have to go to the Senate Judiciary Committee? I said, I thought there was a rule. He said he wasn't so sure. I've done the work. I've done the heavy lifting. I've gone to the Congressional Research Service. Here's what's been operative since the 1860s. I will quote you. When nominations shall be made by the President of the United States to the Senate, they shall, unless otherwise ordered by the Senate, be referred to the appropriate standing committees. So it's a rule with an out, the out being unless otherwise ordered by the Senate. So the rule in practice is to go to the Senate Judiciary Committee, but the Senate can say no and take it straight to the floor. There have been, I don't know, by my count, rough from memory, 115 to 120 Supreme Court justices. The CRS, the Congressional Research Service, tells us that there have only been 7 nominations that went straight to floor and bypassed the Judiciary Committee. They seem to have been former senators, cabinet members, and in one case, Howard Taft, a former president. So it seemed to be mostly a issue of senatorial courtesy. I think I would not recommend this route, quite honestly. I would rather recommend not doing that, if only for the purpose of having the dual purpose, and I think Rob raised them both. One, showing the Democrats melding their hand as to how they treat people. The memory of what happened to Brett Kavanaugh we thought would never fade, but I think it has faded. You can already see the attacks going on prospectively, perhaps attemptedly, preemptively against Amy Barrett based on her religion. She's a practicing and serious and unapologetic Catholic. The attacks are quite disgusting. I want people to remember, and by remember, seeing in present how the Democrats treat nominees who happen to be Republican. That's one. And two, I would like not to have another round of debates. It's really not debates. Another round of talking points afforded to your Schumers and your Pelosi's and your Sheldon Whitehouses about how irregular a step this is, how much of a breaking of tradition this is. Who cares? It's been done before, right? But I'd rather just not hand them the microphone on that. I'd rather not hand them the microphone for them to have an offensive throw with the football. I'd rather hand them the microphones to hang themselves as a measure of defense by showing the way they act at these committee hearings. They do not comport themselves well. Brett Kavanaugh's hearing is certainly one of them. How about the way they treated Bill Barr? That was not a win for them. These are not wins for them. We show the American people who they are. The American people don't end up liking it. You know why? They're not likable people. We'll come right back and examine this further. As we go to break, let me just remind you of my favorite video and social media conferencing tool, which is SquadPod. I want you to check them out at squadpod.com. That's squadpod.com/Seth. Tons of great features, all American made. In fact, housed right here in Arizona. It's a company that shares your values with a bunch of great features, unlike the other guys. And unlike the other guys, they guarantee your privacy and your free speech. To collaborate, screen share, share files, chat, check out squadpod.com/Seth. Rob, you're calling back on my answer to your earlier query, yes?
Actually, yes. And not only that, but, I mean, great minds must think alike, because I did look at the Congressional Research Service under Senate.gov summary that you had stated, you know, the first part. First of all, it's important for everybody to know, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, there are 12 Republicans and 10 Democrats, okay? So we have, and I checked because I counted. So first of all, we do have a Republican majority in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and that's very important. Reading further down, oh, and I also had looked at Senate.gov under the rules of the Senate Judiciary Committee in a separate thing, and there was nothing specific about anything written down that requires specifically a Supreme Court justice to come before the Senate Judiciary Committee. And that, coupled with reading a little further down on that congressional research summary, it'll talk about the committee, in this case, the Senate Judiciary Committee, often gathers information about a nominee either before or instead of a formal hearing. The Senate committee considering a nomination has four options. It can report the nomination to the Senate favorably or unfavorably or without recommendation, or it can choose to take no action. So that's part of number one. Then there's something called Rule 22 that has to do with the Senate, and I guess this would be Mitch McConnell's job to allow cloture to be invoked on nominations to the Supreme Court by a majority of senators voting. Now, so we add this information to the invocation of cloture, and cloture has to do with some, you know, maybe Mitch McConnell standing up and saying, okay, we've talked about this enough. Now we're going to go ahead and take this to a vote. There was a later thing about cloture, reinterpreting the Rule 22 thing, that shortened the time from, I think, 30 hours to 2 hours, but that didn't necessarily include Supreme Court justice nominees. But the way I see it, you know, and theoretically, and I think the more I think about it, you may be right, that having a hearing, and because of American short-term memory, who may not remember the injustice invoked upon Justice Kavanaugh, that maybe a hearing might be the last great exposure of the complete unprincipled nature of the Democrat Party and their
I just don't want to hand him another talking point, that's all. I know we can answer it, but I hate always being on defense, you know?
Yeah, and so, you know, in a sense, I guess maybe we're both right. Technically, they don't necessarily need to do a hearing, and that's going to be up to Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell. But the Republicans do have a majority in the Judiciary Committee. And by bringing forth, and I'm not entirely sure it might be Amy, I think there's a possibility, you know, there's that Hispanic.
There's four they're talking about, yeah. There's four they're talking about. It may not be Amy. Yeah, it may not.
Yeah, which again, and this is something a lot of people don't know either. When Amy was selected for, was it the appellate or circuit? I can't remember. She was approved already by the Senate on an 80-15 vote. And that means to me she's already been vetted.
Yeah, we've tried that one before, too. We've tried that one before, too. Ask Clarence Thomas about being vetted.
Again, that's a good point.
Kavanaugh. Ask Brett Kavanaugh about being vetted.
Absolutely.
I just don't want to offer them. You know, I'll tell you a good example of this is how much we have to, you know, I've said, you've heard me say, I'm not sure if you agree or not, but you've heard me say it's harder to be a conservative than a liberal because we're always having to answer the onslaught. We always have to answer the onslaught, and the onslaught sometimes sticks a little stronger than the response. Than the response, even if the response wins the day. I was talking with Roger Kimball as my guest early in the hour, and we were revisiting the Smithsonian and Black History Museum's education to America about how to tell if you're white. And you may remember this. I've spent, I don't know how many days on it, a week, I think, and how many monologues, at least three. And I've received I don't know how many emails in the last 20 minutes saying, wait, what are you guys talking about? Send me a link. I want to know about this. This sounds odious. They didn't say odious, but this sounds harmful. So, you know, we constantly have to be, what's the old line from the movie, always be closing. We have to constantly be reminding, constantly be answering. So I'd rather not have to just give them the microphone. Well, what will be remembered from this strategic maneuver, what will be remembered is that there was something odd or different about it. I think it is entirely, I don't think, it is entirely normal when there is a vacancy in the Supreme Court for the president to nominate the replacement and the Senate to vote up or down on that through the advice and consent clause. Typically goes to the Judiciary Committee and then the full Senate for a vote. Let's just do it.
That's right.
Let's just
that's
do right. it. You know, no yep. questions yeah. need be asked. That's my
that's
view.
Correct. And that's why, you know, I initially said, let's do an up or down vote, because you know, that's really all that's technically needed under both the Constitution and the Senate rules. But as you say,
do you know how much we're going to hear from Chuck Schumer and Nancy about that?
I know.
Yeah,
I know. And of course, Dianne Feinstein.
They say the safest, the most unsafe place in D.C. is between Chuck Schumer and a microphone. Let's create some safe spaces.
Harris,
I say let's
Kamala
create.
Is
yeah.
on the Judiciary
yeah.
Committee, isn't she?
Yeah. I say let's create some safe spaces.
Yeah. No, that's my stuff. Anyway, that's my 2 cents worth. I'm with you, as always. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see how all this plays out.
Well, that will be the understatement of the day. It will be interesting to see. Well, it'll keep you and I busy, won't it, Rob, and all our listeners and all Republicans. Yeah, no, you're either on offense or defense in the game of politics. And I'd rather be on offense, or at least not having to turn the ball over. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Like you, I work pretty hard. I travel a fair amount. I can't afford to slow down. You know, I can't afford to be absent from you, especially during this time. That's why I want to keep my energy and my health and my immunity all boosted and at its peak level of performance. That's why I take Balance of Nature. Balance of Nature, just take it once a day. All whole food, plants, fruits, and vegetables reduced, locked into vegetarian capsules. They themselves picked at the peak of ripeness, the fruits and veggies, all organic, no chemicals, no GMOs. And I am good to go. It's powerful, robust stuff, from blueberries and oranges to garlic, cayenne, pepper, carrots. I've not been sick since I've taken it, since I started taking it back in, I think, October it was. And I've been, you know, Europe, Middle East, around America. You'll love it as much as I do, I've no doubt. Go to balanceofnature.com to check out their fruits and veggies. They have a great deal right now, 35% off any new preferred order of their fruits and veggies, and free shipping. Free shipping and 35% off any new preferred order of the fruits and veggies. Balanceofnature.com. Make sure to use discount code BALANCE. Danny has been holding for a long time. I'm sorry, Danny. Welcome. Hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. First-time caller.
Welcome.
I am calling regarding what I received over the weekend was my general election pamphlet.
Publicity pamphlet, yeah.
Correct. And there on page 53 is the list of judges.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they don't list their parties, what they're affiliated with. And I contacted the Arizona GOP, and they indicated to me that they went or are waiting on information from an outside, non-biased group of some sort to supply them with information regarding the judges. Now, I kind of see this as being flawed, because if they send out a questionnaire to some attorneys, and they happen to be Democrat attorneys, and the judge rules in their favor, of course, they're going to give a positive result back on the questionnaire. So that pretty much goes out the window. So I I guess, you know, I don't know if I want to say I'm anal about this whole thing, but that's why I'm an absentee ballot person. I take the time to go through and try to research these judges. But in this case, on this election, there's 49 judges.
Yeah. They may have been talking about interest organizations that they were waiting for. One that typically does it that I can recommend, and I've recommended people look to in the past when it comes to judges, is the Center for Arizona Policy. In years past, the Center for Arizona Policy has put out their recommendations on those things, and I think they're fairly trustworthy. Check that out, Danny. And check out page 85 of your pamphlet, too. You might see a name you recognize there. Sorry, it was a short segment. I hope that answers it. I'm Seth Leibson. I'll be right back. You can always email me if it doesn't.